Anna here. Did you know I have another podcast? And did you know it's all about failure? Well, at this point, you'd have to answer yes to both of those questions because I just told you. But my other show isn't just about failure. It's about failing your way to success. Yes, success. Because the most successful people are often just the people who've gotten up the most times after their failures. Don't believe me? Go download Fail Your Way to Success wherever you get your podcasts, or go to failyourway.com for more info. Now back to the show.
On Good Authority has had over a million downloads, regularly appears on the top 100 career podcast list, and has been named one of the best publishing podcasts by LA Weekly and Kindlepreneur. Please welcome OG Authority host, New York Times best-selling author, Anna David.
There are people who launch books end up just having a nice thing to put on their shelves. Then there are people who launch books that transform their careers and their lives. As a former member of the first group, I strongly urge you to be part of the second. In this show, I talk to entrepreneurs and authors about how to intentionally launch the book that will serve as the best business card and marketing tool you've ever had. Get ready for takeoff. Anna here with what you could call a long overdue episode, or you could call an episode that I was never planning to release because I wasn't planning to release any more episodes of this podcast. However, I was doing an interview with a guest for my other podcast, Fail Your Way to Success. I hope you're subscribed. And he had so much to say about publishing that I thought, you know what? I'm just going to spontaneously make half of this episode about publishing and the other half, the one we are planning to. So this is who it is. Kevin Anderson. He is the CEO and editor-in-chief of Kevin Anderson and Associates. And they are the biggest ghostwriting, editing, and publishing services company. They have a long list of notable clients, number one best-selling authors, publishers, agents, hundreds of employees, and he is so knowledgeable about publishing. In this episode, we talk about the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and USA Today list. We talk about the struggles of traditional publishing. We talked about so many things that I am reviving a dormant podcast. So with that, I give you Kevin Anderson.
We first started the company. We were doing a lot of, you know, editing and writing of public manuscripts, and we thought it made a lot of sense to just be also a self-publishing source for authors. And so we hired someone in house, a designer, and she was actually great. But it was, you know, it turned out to be a real nightmare. We had a high volume of clients because everyone really wanted to use us because they were already with us for a long period of time with ghostwriting or editing. And it just became such a headache. God bless any self-publisher or hybrid publisher. I mean, any little tiny thing, like one period might be out of place and, you know, clients would want like a full refund or something like that. And so we just, you know, we experimented. It was maybe 10 years ago. We did that for maybe a year or so. And we just said, you know what? We just got to let the people who do this best do this and just, you know, hand our clients off to them instead. So, yeah, that was definitely, I would consider that a failure. But in general, you know, we've made a lot of zigs and zags, you know, just trying different things out. And if it doesn't work, then just, you know, go in with what does and just doubling down on that instead of trying to, whatever the analogy is, draw a flood from a stone. You know, we just really kind of go with what's really working and focus on our strengths.
Well, of course, this is landing on the opposite of deaf ears because I have a hybrid publishing company. And I always say, who else is in a business where you have 300 pages on which you could make a mistake? It is. And of course, traditionally published books often have typos, egregious typos, but you don't ask for a refund if you're a traditionally published author because they paid you. We often point out, you know, we go through four edits and we just often point out these are human beings and human beings may make errors and we will fix them. But fascinating. So to me, we were sort of talking about this before we started recording it. I mean, you're sort of the industry's best kept secret it is, as somebody who comes from traditional publishing, it looks to me like all the publishers know who you are, but you've been really good at remaining behind the scenes. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, I guess maybe that's aligned with like a ghostwriting, you know, service. But you know, it's we made a shift, and I think it was in around 2018 or so, we made a shift to really bring in a lot of in-house talent from the traditional publishers. So that's when we started hiring former acquisitions editors or current acquisitions editors at a really high level, like executive level, and even editorial directors at the big five houses. And we brought them in-house, and they became our in-house talent. And that shift really moved us much more into, you know, the traditional publishing space and more into the limelight. And that's when we really started working a lot more with, you know, the big agencies and literary agencies and the big five houses, as well as a bunch of indies. Before that, we had some successes. You know, we hit the New York Times bestseller list with a bunch of different books. The Five Nights at Freddy's was a really big hit for us. That was a number one New York Times bestseller for 18 weeks until they dissolved the paperback YA category, which was a bummer. But yeah, it was more, you know, we were more of a matchmaking outfit at that time. It was like, you know, we would manage the projects, but we were often bringing in freelancers to do any editorial work. And then in 2007, like I said, around 17, 18, we really switched to just having that in-house talent, the in-house editors, where people could, you know, if they wanted to have a HarperCollins caliber editor working on their book or book proposal, you know, they could just come to us and pay for that service, rather than having to seduce a publisher through a book proposal to get that same service.
Well, and on your website, there's Brené Brown and Jen Sincero. And did your team, you know, they've worked on books like that?
Yeah, that's their book. So, yeah, Brené Brown was Jess Sindler's book. She was at Harper at Day Street, which is an imprint of Harper. Yeah, Jen Sincero is that's Jennifer Cassius's book. She discovered Jen when she was at Running Press, which is an imprint of Hachette. And so, yeah, those are the books. Those are their authors that they discovered and edited and launched. And so, yeah, it's that caliber of editor that you get with us, whether you're writing, whether it's a ghostwriting project or whether it's editing or just advice. Those are the editors that are working directly with our clients, getting in the same room with them, talking with them through everything, going back and forth with them, book coaching, guiding them through the whole, you know, the whole writing and publishing process.
And they must, we're getting insider baseball on this publishing stuff and not talking about failure yet, but they must, like, it must be much more satisfying as an editor, because at a big house, you have so many books, and oftentimes you really cannot invest in each author. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, it can be tricky at the publishers. I think, you know, the feedback that we get from our team is more that when they were at the traditional houses, a lot of their time wasn't actually spent editing the book. You know, they were in P&L meetings, they were in, you know, bobblehead meetings and merchandise meetings and cover art meetings and you know, for a lot of the team that we have in house, like, they were, the only time they were editing books was evenings and weekends, not even the you know, the 9-to-5 job that they actually had with their employer. Whereas here, they're really working, like, you know, 9-to-5, they are working with the author, with the manuscript. They're not responsible for any of those other kind of those other distractions, other than just working directly with the author and on their manuscript.
And that is why I will say, for my first three books with Harper, I have no evidence my editor actually read my manuscript. And I thought, when it's your first three books, you just think, oh, I guess I'm brilliant, and it doesn't need any editing. And when I got an editor on my fourth book who actually did something, it was a rude awakening.
Well, you know, that's what you want, though, right? I mean, so a lot, you know, that we always get frustrated with the publishers, and there's many of them out there, that just don't do almost don't do anything at all with the manuscript. There's no advice. There's no developmental edit. It's basically, you know, they're just doing a copy edit and putting their stamp on it. And it's always nice when you get an editor at a house that really invests in the project, is getting their hands dirty, making changes, really invested in making it the best book it can be. Of course, you know, you can have the other version of that, where they're really making it into some, you know, they're going in a different direction than what you would, you know, prefer. But you know, I'll always choose someone that's, you know, getting involved than just kind of letting it go as it is.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a friend who had the same editor, and I looked, and he was a very big deal writer, and I looked at what that editor was doing. I mean, just forgive the crassness. Like, he was like peeing on all, like a dog peeing on every page so that he could have ownership of this book that was going to be, you know, a big deal book. And I saw what he was capable of. It was fascinating. So, you know, by the way, I have a second podcast, which is called On Good Authority, that's all about book publishing, where I'm not recording new interviews. But what I'm realizing is I'm going to release this on both.
But wow, great.
Two podcasts for the time of one. So, because we're just getting into it, and it's fascinating to me. So in terms of traditional publishing, what aspect of it would you say is potentially broken today?
Oh, geez. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot that, I mean, traditional publishing has been struggling, right? What part of it's broken? I mean, right now, a big frustration is that, you know, I mean, you see these celebrity books that keep, you know, making it and getting big deals. And it's really, really hard for smaller authors that don't have a big platform or a lot of followers already to kind of break in. That's frustrating. You know, publishers they're risk averse. You know, they're trimming down their teams. They're really looking at the P&Ls closely. So, you know, I get it from their standpoint. You know, that you want to make good business decisions, and it's risky. You know, to invest in authors that aren't a guaranteed P&L.
Anna here. Now, are you an entrepreneur who wants to write and publish a book about your own failures turned successes? Well, good news. That's what my company, Legacy Launchpad, does. Find out more at legacylaunchpadpub.com. That's legacylaunchpadpub.com. Now, should you do a book, you ask? I think so. Why? Because you're worth it. Now back to the show.
But it really is, it's tough for an author that might have a really great, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, that has a really great idea or a great story. But they just, you know, the only... It's them and their manuscript, and there's not a whole lot of proof of concept when it comes to selling books. And so that's, I think that's a real drawback with the traditional, and that's why you see so many authors, you know, making decisions to go to non-traditional publishers and see if they can make it that way.
Do you see this ever being able to be fixed? Okay, before I say that, you know, I got in 2005, and you didn't have to have a platform. Instagram didn't exist. Only college students were on Facebook. It was a much better time for new people to break out. Do you ever see it switching back?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the rise of the hybrid has been so strong, and self-publishing options are growing and becoming more and more sophisticated. And they're finding ways to get into the traditional marketplace and get traditional distribution and sales that were typically only relegated to traditional publishers. And they're able to kind of break into that. And a lot of these traditional publishers, they're offering their sales and distribution to hybrid publishers and to, self-published outfits that are like basically self-publishers. I think they're adapting and figuring out ways to still earn money in this kind of economy. But I don't know. That's I'm not sure if it's going to get fixed. I think they'll have to figure out an answer for it though. And I think they're well aware of these concerns. But I mean, you could see a model where traditional publishing just ends up being kind of a place where people with big platforms go. And then, you know, these other, non-traditional outfits and indie publishers become really the place where you see, those authors succeed. But yeah, it's hard to say. I'm not really sure which direction it's going to go.
The tragic thing is, and I'm sure it happens to you all the time, you run across people who tell you so excitedly about their idea, and you have to break their heart and say, ideas actually don't matter. It is a great idea, or it's not a great idea. It's irrelevant because you cannot get a traditional deal.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a couple different ways to look at that. I mean, there's some authors that come in and they just say, they're so excited about their idea that they'll say like, hey, we'll be 50-50 partners. And when you hear my idea, you'll love it so much.
I love that one.
You'll pay me to be a part of this. your book. And then you're kind of breaking hearts there with the reality check. But then, you do have the others. And, it's especially difficult. Like with fiction and memoir, there's still a chance, right? Like you still have a chance just based on the quality of your writing and but it's really hard because you've got to connect with an agent, right? Like you've got to find an advocate. And so it becomes kind of a dating game. Like, you're putting out that query, you're hoping that an agent really connects with that material and wants to put themselves behind it to get a publisher. With nonfiction, though, especially prescriptive nonfiction, I mean, there is a path forward. If they really are set on traditional publishers, there is a path forward to start to build your platform, start to build something, some sort of plan where you can sell books. It takes time, though, right? It takes a lot of time and effort. But I do think there is a way forward there if you really want to have a traditional publisher. But a lot of, as you can imagine, a lot of authors now are saying, well, let me just come out with a book and do a non-traditional publisher and start building my platform that way. And maybe book two, I'll once I've got my platform, I've got my first book out and I've got some proof of concept, then I'll, 2 years, 3 years later, I'll go try for a big five house.
Yeah. I mean, the problem I think too, is that people go, okay, I've got to go build a platform. I'll post on Instagram. And it's sort of like, well, I just met this kid who's a TikTok expert. And I said, what's the secret? And he goes, posting 40 videos a day. And I'm like, okay, well, that's not going to work.
Yeah. And also like your book has like, it's one thing if you have a million followers, but what are they following you for? Yeah. Like, what is it that they want from you? Is it what, are they going to be book buyers? Like, do they care about some piece of wisdom that you have that you're going to give them this book enough so that they're going to pay $25 or $30 for that book? I mean, that's a totally different thing. So we get a lot of clients that, they'll have huge platforms, but they're not active. Those platforms aren't related to the wisdom that they want to share in a book, right? Like they're there for, whatever, pranks they're playing on the, whatever it is, but it's not related directly to a need that they're solving with their message. So that's why you see, we see a lot of publishers right now that are actually, they're not as excited by these social media platforms as they used to be. I think they've seen a lot of misses where the big platform, big social media, and then the book just doesn't sell. When you have someone who's selling out events and getting in front of real people and, an in-demand speaker at conferences, in demand with podcast circuits, these are selling much more books than often the case than like just a big social media platform. There's also a lot of nefarious stuff going on with social media platform building and stuff that it's hard to parse through. And unless you really can look through the analytics and see what the engagement level of that audience really is and how they're engaging, it can be, there's a lot of trickery going on to try to make it look like it's a much more viable platform than it really is.
Yes. Do you remember that New York Times story about Justin Timberlake's and Billie Eilish's books and how they bombed despite the millions and millions of followers? Because if your followers aren't readers or you're not telling them about your book, it doesn't matter. I mean, that's exactly what you were just saying.
Right. Or maybe they're just there for the music.
Yeah.
Right. They don't really care what you have to say. They don't really want to know about all the details of your life. Maybe it just depends. There's different, like something like Britney Spears. I mean, that's going to sell like crazy because people are very interested in her life. Right. They want to know what's behind the scenes. They've been invested in her for years and she's had a very dramatic life. So you can see how that book sells. Right. Whereas some others, why are they going to buy that book? Like, so you got to think about your audience and why they're going to spend $30 on whatever you have to say.
Speaking of the Britney Spears book, she turned down all traditional media. What do you think of that as she just promoted it through her Instagram? What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, good for her that she could do that. That's a privileged place to be, that you have that kind of following that you funnel people that way. I mean, it's great for her. I mean, I like controlling the narrative. There's a journalistic side of it that makes you, I don't know. I'd like to see a little bit more exposure and having to answer questions, I guess, on other platforms. But yeah, I mean, that's great for her. I think it's really difficult for most authors to do something like that though. I mean, you really, most authors are just desperately trying to get any kind of media and attention that they can get to try to make sure that they're getting their story out there and getting in front of potential readers.
Speaking, you were saying sort of nefarious methods for looking like your social media is bigger than it is. Let's talk about the list. What about the nefarious methods of getting on the New York Times list? What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I've got a lot to say about all that. I mean, all the lists, the best on the list, they're all different in what they measure and why you can hit certain lists and how. And, the Times list is harder to rig than others, right? Because it's a subjective list. It's an editorial list. And, they make no apologies about this. You can outsell the number one book and all the things could look right. I mean, you could sell in all different markets, all different mediums. You could, it could sell strong over time. And ultimately the Times, their editorial team could just say, nope, we're not going to include this one. But of course that does, that doesn't stop people from really trying and doing bulk buys and running them through points of sale to make it look like, 10,000 people bought a book when only one person did. So you definitely have that's definitely a thing. And it can work really easily. It works really well, at a high percentage with the other lists, like the Wall Street Journal, which is on hiatus at the moment, and the USA Today list. The Times, they really watch out for that. So it's, it seems like it's difficult. And of course you get the dagger too, right? If they suspect any kind of bulk buying, you get the dagger, which just indicates that there was some, and that dagger's with you forever, right? And sometimes the dagger is really unfair, I have to say. Like, we've seen it sometimes where it's just like a conference or something like that. And, there's a perfectly good reason for a bulk purchase. And yet, you get that dagger and it's there forever. I think Atomic Habits has a dagger, but that book sells like 20,000 copies a week. So, the best on the list, it's one of those things though. I mean, it's really important for some authors because especially an author where their ROI comes from being, a best-selling author, being an authority in their space and hitting that list is everything for them because it ups their speaking fee. It makes them, it's something that they can care, like to the day they die, they'll be a New York Times best-selling author or Wall Street Journal best-selling author, national bestseller, best-selling author. So that's why you do see so much emphasis with these authors on just like the pre-orders, getting the pre-orders as many as possible, which they all count, for sales for that first week. And then really doing any kind of events and conferences and just bulking up on that first couple of weeks, especially the first week of pub, just to make sure that you're doing everything possible to hit, hit a list. Cause that is really your best chance at hitting the list. I can see, you can definitely see the value in it and why people are so hung up on it. Of course, publishers see it a little bit differently. Publishers, the list is a little bit more of just kind of a cherry on the top. A publisher will always take a book that sells 1,000 copies a week for, a year straight than a book that sold, 10,000 copies on the first week and then, only a couple copies every week after. But you'll see that a lot too. I mean, when you look at a book scan, you'll see like these books that are just selling, like they'll sell like 40,000 copies the first week and then like 1,000 the second and then like, 8 the third. And then, and when you see that kind of a pattern, that there's obviously been a lot of bulk buying going on.
When you said Wall Street Journalist is on hiatus, does that mean it's coming back?
The reports that I'm getting are that it is going to come back. They had a little issue with Tricana, which is the book scan, the company around book scan. So I've heard though that they are going to try to make it come back. It might not look the same as it was before. I mean, USA Today list, that went off as well for a while. That was gone for it felt like a long time. It was at least 8 months, if not a year. And then they came back and they're doing reporting a little bit differently than they did before. And of course the Times list is still around. And then, those seem to be the only lists that are really getting people's attention though. Those are the ones that you can put national bestseller on the front of your book. Like a publisher, if you hit the Porchlight, which is a great list, the Porchlight bestseller list, no publisher is going to put national bestseller on the front cover for that. So that's why those three lists are so high in demand.
Yeah, I had assumed that the Wall Street Journal list went away because they sort of saw people gaming that, but it wasn't that?
It could be part of it. This is a don't quote me thing, but all the reports I've got is there was an issue contractually, and they did not renew the contract with Turkana. And they're going to work it out. Is what I hear. Something's going to get worked out and they're going to come back. But I'm not in that boardroom, so I don't know what's going behind the scenes. It's only rumors.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. Now, a request from me. If you've ever used any of the tips or techniques you've heard about from the show, please take a few seconds to give the show a rating or review and find out all about how my company, Legacy Launchpad, writes and launches books at www.legacylaunchpadpub.com. See you next week.